This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 23rd of May, 1963. The title of this lecture is State of OT. Copyright 1963 by L. Ron Hubbard in the United Kingdom. Copyright 1978 by L. Ron Hubbard in the USA. All rights reserved. Unauthorized translation, duplication, importation, and distribution is a violation of applicable laws. This tape is 71 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Well, thanks for bringing me up to present time. What is present time? 23rd of May, AD 13, the year of the OT. Everybody's calling it the year of the clear, and we never had a chance. Went right over that, you know. All right. We could say that we started the ball rolling to a very marked degree in Australia and California. We've got things pretty well going around the world in general. There are some rough spots. My main problem is I was presented with a bunch of government-type corporation data and tax structure data and so forth today, and was actually trying to get some time in a little bit earlier and trying to put this stuff together. It's very amusing. Every now and then an accountant or somebody of that sort wonders why I have not paid more attention to this particular facet of our activities. The only lesson I have learned is when I let the control and copyrights of Dianetics and Scientology get out from under, it gave some very aberrated wog a wonderful idea that he could knock us all off, and it caused a lot of trouble. So that's about the only thing I've been careful of. And the idea of putting together Earth-type corporations, government-type corporations, you see, has always been rather amusing to me. I'm afraid that's the truth of the matter. And at a very much earlier time in the development of Dianetics and Scientology, I was able to look this over and realize that there wasn't any government on Earth that had any right to give us a license to survive. They all try to assert this right, don't you say? And I didn't go into any vast games condition with them. But it was the realization that we needed a structure fitted to our needs, rather than a mildewed Earth-type corporation, that made me somewhat lackadaisical in breaking my neck to put together Earth-type corporations, you see. And I've now collided with the necessity of setting up a better corporate structure. And Earth-type corporation, of course, must be there because of taxation, because of this and because of that and so on. But to expect an Earth government to protect us one way or the other is laughable. It isn't like setting the lion to protect the lamb. I'm afraid that is not it. It's setting an ant, you see, to guard the citadel. And it doesn't, you know, it's just silly. So I am faced with this and quite a few other problems at this particular time. And with everything else, you say, well, how do you be faced with those problems, too? Well, I managed to get faced with a lot of problems. I learned the other night that a present time problem is only caused by not having enough time. And that actually blew all my present time problems. It was just a cognition. You want to know why you've got a present time problem? Well, you just don't have enough time. You see? Time factor is missing out of it, so therefore it's a present time problem. It's as simple as that. Now, very many things come up, and looking over and examining the state of planets and civilizations before the heliotropous implants, call them the heaven implants, public will understand it a little bit better, but they are the implants implanted by this, wasn't even a confederacy, this interplanetary nation called heliotropous. Little pipsqueak government, didn't amount to very much. They had gold crosses on their planes, and they'd sort of assumed the status of like the American Red Cross or something of the sort, and everybody thought they were nice, ineffectual people. Nobody could trace down who was doing all of it. And these characters had developed some technology. This technology probably was not totally unknown around about the place, but nobody put it together or combined it with an energy which was peculiarly commanding upon a Thetan. Now, that energy was cold energy. And that's probably the big mystery about you wonder what this energy was. Actually, it's frozen energy. It's based on the fact that certain energies do not thrive in sub-sub-sub-zero temperatures. And this is a cold energy action, so therefore your PCs get very cold and get very hot and so on while running it. Now, they were able to put significance very directly into this energy so that it tended to talk, and which was an interesting electronic trick. But all of that so commands your attention that you overlook another factor. They had figured out, above all things, this is fantastic, something which looked to everyone else like a natural phenomenon. And I can see the learned MIT-type scientist now sitting around explaining the presence of radioactive clouds. We call them in Earth's astronomy lingo a Magellanic cloud. Those exist in tremendous profusion toward the center of a galaxy. There are tremendous quantities of these huge radioactive clouds. Anybody that's ever been through planet building or anything like that recognizes these things. It's the cloud that you bung a big mass into to make it fission and collect all the particles to become a sun. And anyway, these are in enormous profusions toward the center of a galaxy. And when we say galaxy, we mean one of those wheels that you see in the astronomy textbooks. And when we say an island of galaxies or an island galaxy or something, we mean six or eight of these wheels. And they're clustered together. And this universe is composed of a collection of galaxies isolated from other collections of galaxies, you see. They've recently started to call these things island universes. I don't know why, but that fits in with Earth technology on the thing. Well, anyway, one of these great spinning wheels has, of course, in it just literally billions of stars. I don't know what the factor is. I was going to say trillions. I don't, perhaps not that high. Maybe it's higher. And every one of these stars is capable of having planets. And it's greater oddity to find a star without planets than it is with one. The egocentric characteristic of man dictates Earth as the only planet that goes around a sun. I consider this very, very interesting. But it just shows you how bad off you can get after you've been implanted. Anyway, the system of stars in its greatest aggregate, of course, is visible as this thing called a galaxy. And you'll see pictures of them in astronomy textbooks. You want to get one of these kids' astronomy textbooks, if this is beyond you. As an auditor, you may have need of the data. Know what the devil the PC's talking about. Not because you tell the PC, but there it is. And one of these great wheels tends to be rather oblong, and the stars tend to be massed up toward the hub. They're not a good sphere, or they're not a sphere, they're a flat wheel. And they got a hub, and they got a rim, and this pattern of stars scattered in. When you look up toward the Milky Way, and when you see the whitest portion of the Milky Way on a clear night, you're looking straight at the hub of this particular galaxy. And when you look in the opposite direction, you're looking at scattered patterns of stars, even though some of them are quite large, and you're looking out away from the hub. And doing that, you recognize that Earth is an awful long way from being at the center of this galaxy. In fact, it is classifiable as a rim star. Now, these galaxies, in composition, are, of course, a great condensed radioactive cloud of some kind or another that existed at one time or another. And you've got a condensation. And this condensation brings about a sun, and then because of the orbital influences of bits of matter and so forth, these collect around the edges of it and are formed as planets. And these planets sometimes shatter. They have political accidents or something. And you'll get a belt of asteroids. And the planets vary in numbers, and classified at a higher level of astronomy, each type of star has its own classification, depending not so much on its order of magnitude, although that is there too, but on the brilliance per mass. It's the brilliance per mass of a star. So that you get actually coal black stars. They look coal black. You get up right close to them, you find out they're red hot. Well, that's been referred to as a dead sun or something like this. And pretty grisly if you ever happen to not navigate correctly because they get in your road most god-awfully. They don't radiate enough to be detected. Anyway, and that moves up to your dull reds. And then that moves up the dull red sun. You can see these things. Let's see, where is there one around here? There's, which one is it? Aldebaran, I think, is a dull red one. There's one up there in Taurus, the constellation Taurus, and it is bright red. And then you move up from that, you get to a yellow sun. And that is more or less the characteristic of Earth's sun. It is tends to be more yellow than otherwise. And then you move up to a higher radiation factor, and you get a white sun, and you get a blue sun. Those are the various radiation factors. Your white and blue there may be interchanged. But the point I'm making is there's different brilliances, and then there's different masses for these brilliances. And all those these things have some relationship. Now, you go down into the tropics, you'll get ultraviolet in a meat body. You're liable to get ultraviolet poisoning, because the sun's rays are so directly ahead that you get too much ultraviolet. Well, around a brilliantly blue sun, of course, these types of rays are just pounding away all the time, all the time, all the time, and you'd fry in the type of body you're in. Nevertheless, just because a meat body is at a highly critical temperature and mass level, that is to say, it can only live on a planet of so much mass, it can only live on a planet of so much heat or cold, you see, is no reason why life forms or bodies, which have two arms and two legs and a head and so forth, no reason why bodies don't exist that can stand these extremes. And the upshot of this is that the science fiction writer is always trying to tell you about, you see, the science fiction writer's memory is faulty. And he gets himself all re-stimulated and so forth. And he doesn't remember straight. Some of them remember quite well, but then they reverse their time. We wouldn't quite know why that is. And put it all into the future, which I consider quite interesting. They, of course, wouldn't know anything about the implants that turn every tall time backwards. Now, I imagine in the days of Columbus, you go along the docks, you'd hear some old salt who has been actually outside the breakwater explaining to some young aspirant as to why Columbus cannot reach the other side of the ocean. And you hear tales of monsters and that sort of thing because you mustn't go out there, you see, and horrible monsters of the sea, and they have huge tentacles and they gobble you up, you see, and they swallow whole ships and all of this sort of thing. You would have found that very current in Cadiz, the port of embarkation there. just before Columbus's sailing. Well, it's worse than that. These tales were probably spread by the Phoenicians, who made regular voyages from the Mediterranean to England to pick up tin and didn't want anybody else cutting in on their racket, see? And so they talked about these monsters that existed at sea, and it was all terrible, and you didn't dare venture out through the Pillars of Hercules or out of the sight of land because you'd get et up. Well, mothers have the same trouble. They tell their little children if they aren't good that somebody will get them, or the boogeyman, or something like this. In other words, this is a standard mechanism about the boogeyman and the terrible beings and all of that sort of thing. It's a standard mechanism that's used for various reasons in various places. And that has existed through this universe. So that most people have parked somewhere in their consciousness the idea that if they went to the planet Jippo, you see, that there they would find huge tube-like creatures, you see, that would suck you all up at a glump, see, and, you know, boogies. And the science fiction writer, being the furthest from reality on the situation, is liable to perpetuate the boogie faster than he perpetuates fact. I should not decry him because he's done a pretty good job. But the truth of the matter is that most planets are inhabited by and lived on by and run by animal forms quite similar to Earth's. Actually, they classify by rings. So many planets out from a yellow or a 12th-rate sun has a certain type of flora and fauna for each one of its continents. You see, it's all classifiable. But you get this modified then when you go out into the next planetary ring, and you get this modified when you go into the next planetary ring, you see. But it's more or less classified. It's pretty standard. It's what can adapt to that particular type of environment. And although I don't think you'd have very much pleasure out of kissing a girl from Jupiter, that's a heavy gravity planet. And if you stepped on the planet Jupiter in one of these meat bodies that you presently have, you would become a pancake promptly, you see. And what atmosphere it has lies in seas of liquid air and so on. You might say this is somewhat rigorous as an environment, not completely similar to Russia, but well, so you get these, do get these various variations. And it's not all that horrifying, however. You find somebody running around that, he's like a planet Jupiter, he'd be built to withstand that climatic condition and that gravitic condition and so forth. And his legs might be a bit modified and his arms and that sort of thing, but he probably would look like an Eskimo. The truth of the matter is then that the universe is not a strange place filled full of terrifying beings of one kind or another, but in actual fact it's a rather pleasant place, except where people have been very, very busy making it an unpleasant place. Now, if you face up to what has happened to make bodies and what has been done with this universe, you could become very disheartened and you could become very caved in. And you could say, well, this universe then is fully and completely a trap, until you recognize that this factor has occurred. The Thetan is helped all the time by Mest. All the time, all the time, all the time, all the time by Mest. It gives him consecutive scenery, gives him location. These are all things which he is not just been overwhelmed by, but things which are actually things that he likes. It gives him a permanent, persistent structure of matter. He can put up a little shadow of a house today or something like that, and it's there tomorrow, you see. If he forgets about it, it doesn't disappear. All kinds of problems that Thetan had have been solved by this universe, and he's on a one-way help flow. When he gets too far down, universe helps him, he doesn't help the universe.
Somebody who's in that frame of mind, you can simply ask this simple question. How could you help the physical universe? You get the degree, it helps him. Makes a stuck flow. All right, how could you help the physical universe? And he's liable to calm lag on that first answer for a little while, but he suddenly will come up to with a whole bunch of answers, and he'll suddenly feel better about this universe. In other words, if the universe is anything, it's too good for you. And people can't stand this, so they decide the best universe is evil. So every once in a while, you get some bloke that decides to make it a very evil place. And he'll get some wild, weird idea of what is wrong with it. Well, the exact origin of the physical universe, and thinking then, just to finish that paragraph, what he thinks is wrong with it is inevitably that it has free beings in it. He always comes to this conclusion, if he's that degraded. And therefore starts to get very busy to make beings unfree. The net result of this is chaos. The origin of the universe in the first place is probably, and this is very hypothetical, even though we have found this type of thing time and time again, it hasn't been too well explored. Probably was a collision of home universes. Everybody was busy building a universe, and it had some sort of, it wasn't in any time period. Its collision, one by one and another by another, would form this big universe. It's probably made out of fragments of home universes, some such thing. Well, the problem of why everybody stays in present time is one of the more fantastic problems, and I got a short breakthrough on that not very long ago, which was just this as a breakthrough. There's a vibration, response to a vibration. And that response to a vibration is so uniform that from one end to another, this universe, you have one present time. I don't care if it takes you a long time to reach some other galaxy. It's still vibrating in this exact instant. Or even if its light takes so long to get from it to you, that cuts no ice. In this very split second, it is vibrating at exactly the same vibration. Not only that this universe, this galaxy, you see, is vibrating at, but that you and your bank are vibrating at. In other words, your bank is a bank because it has a vibration of mist. Interesting, isn't it? The only variation in that vibration is time, so therefore you can move somebody on his time track. You can get different sections of the vibration. One time or another, somebody was overwhelmed by or did a lot of overts and overwhelmed others with vibration. It was a very minute vibration. Now, we're talking about a very minute vibration, not the vibration of sound that's terribly coarse, or even supersonic sound, or even the vibration of that. We're talking about the vibration of a light particle. We're talking about the vibrations of the L ring of the electron. We're talking about a vibration now which is unimaginably far away and forgotten as far as the thetan is concerned. And the unison of this vibration of matter is something to which the thetan responds. All of that is very hypothetical, but I've been looking for things which would detach a time track. And this was the an hypothesis I came up with, which might explain the phenomenon of present time. I couldn't think of anything else that would explain the phenomenon of present time. Offhand. Now, the time track itself is formed by an involuntary intention. Now, in studying the power of an operating thetan, I have had very many pauses in my thinking. I knew intellectually the power of an operating thetan. This I knew. And who discussed it, and you'll find it in various books and writings and lectures and so forth about operating thetans. And we all know what we're talking about when we talk about operating thetan. That's what's another weird thing, you see, something that interdefines itself. But instead of just this quasi-intellectual, this intellectual appreciation of the data, I myself have, in very recent weeks, have been exploring the actual potentialities of an operating thetan. And I was giving a demonstration the other day in the instructor's meeting. You take the cellophane off of a packet of cigarettes and set it down all by itself and ask somebody to pick it up without denting it. And don't let it dent even slightly. And he actually won't be able to do it. If you don't believe me, why make it as an experiment sometimes? It's quite impressive. You pick it up, you think, well, you can get your finger on it, and so on. You'll always see a flutter of dent. You can't handle it delicately enough to pick it up without denting it. It isn't just the structure or fabric of it. It's the fact that if you could actually exactly measure the exact pressure to put on that cellophane packet, you could pick it up without a dent occurring in it, without any collapse of its wall or side. That's probably the basic problem of an operating Thetan, and that problem itself may give him his time track. This is a wild bow, isn't it? I mean, how do you make that connection of logic? Well, it's this way. The power of an operating Thetan is such that if he were to pick up a steel cylinder capable of resisting several hundred pounds to the square inch, he would have that same problem that you have with the cellophane. His problem is, how does he touch things without crushing them? He picks up this steel cylinder and he looks at it, and it's got a dent on both sides. And you actually should practice this with some cellophane, with this cellophane cigarette wrapper, to get the exact sensation of being careful that an operating Thetan has in handling mist. You'll find it quite restimulative. Now, in handling this, then, he seeks another method of handling. After you've politely picked up a little boy's toys for him or some friend's mock-up to give it back to him, you see, and it's now lying there in a remarkable state of crumple, you get the idea that you're quite destructive. This brings about the idea of destructivity and lands other people who are, as Susie said the other day, I think the reason they do this is they're just jealous of an operating thing. People who haven't that level of action then are coaxed into believing that an operating Thetan or a free Thetan is a better designation, because we knew of ourselves as free Thetans. You see, there were various kinds of Thetans. A free Thetan was somebody who was relatively, who was free of a body. He wasn't free of organizational commitments or ethics, but he was free of a body. He didn't require any body. Now, this would coax them to believe that a free Thetan was destructive. And they would then lay this into him and even trap him with the idea of making him touch something to break it up, and even build something that looked strong but was fragile to convince him even further, don't you think? That's your first trap, because it caused the free Thetan to pick up a new trick instead of squash things by picking them up. Doing things by intention. Now, we've always thought of that as primary. And it is not primary. It is secondary. The postulate and action through a postulate is secondary through action through energy. You have to be able to do both. It is more natural for a Thetan to pick up this crayon by picking it up, not necessarily mocking beams to pick it up, but by picking it up. You understand? Just picking it up. But if his idea of his own destructivity is so great, he then will develop a secondary means of picking it up. And this secondary means of picking it up is operation by intention. He'll pick it up by postulate. He'll pick it up by intention. He will intend it up. You understand? He can do that too, but it imposes a great restraint on him and is in actual fact a great downgrade from simply picking it up. You sit over something and strain at it to make it move. And this will tend to prove to you that you can't make things move anymore. For as a matter of fact, that is quite unnatural what you're doing, intending to make this move. Intending to make this move. That's quite unnatural. Your actual bent is just to move it. Just move it. Do you get the difference? There's a world of difference. And the reason one stops moving it is because he's afraid he'll destroy it. There won't be anything there to move except some powder. So he develops this trick, which we call an intention. Now this intention, he trains to become involuntary. The involuntary intention. Now that is very far from imaginary, the involuntary intention. You have involuntary muscles which make your heart beat, involuntary breathing arrangements. We're used to this sort of thing. Now, I don't know, they taught me in school about voluntary and involuntary meat bodies, one way or the other, and I used to get awfully mixed up as to which was the ones which went off by themselves and which was the ones that didn't. Let's just bypass the mix-up, and let's say that it is a type of muscle which you don't have to pay any attention to have it work or continue to work. It's a non-intentional action, you see. Same thing as you're saying when you say an involuntary intention. You intend things. Get that as a big difference. To intend this piece of chalk to rise. Satan can do it. But he doesn't have to touch it. And doesn't touch it. He intends it. And it will rise. And that's very downscale. That's monkey business nonsense. That's the same as putting yourself on a fantastic withhold. You'll get that same sensation when you do this one with the cigarette packet cellophane. Take it off the cigarette pack, and after you've seen that you can't pick it up without making it ripple in some way or another, then do the rest of the exercise and sit back and get the idea of intending it to rise. You'll at once get what you once did with other things. Now, on the involuntary intention, it sounds very funny, an OT answering a telephone. You say, what would he be doing answering a telephone? Well, he'd be doing everything answering a telephone. Telephones existed before Alexander Graham Bell. Well, I don't know that that's true. But anyway, the telephone is actually a problem to an operating Thetan. Things are fragile. They short circuit. Their lines fuse. Now, once in a while, you'll see this come up in a co-audit. It came up the other day in some co-audit someplace or another. I've forgotten if it was New York or Sydney. But they threw the goal to forget into the co-audit. One of the first reactions was somebody fused an E-meter. Melted the lines. We've had before somebody drive a hole through an E-meter electrode, but not fuse an E-meter. That was the end of that. So I think probably we'll have to put a fuse. But what did that? That was actually some involuntary reaction on the part of that Thetan was triggered. Here he is sitting here in a meat body holding himself down being good. And somebody just suddenly triggered this, see? And he went, pew, see, and that was the end of those leads. Melted. Yeah, but you can only do that in a blast furnace. Blast furnace. We were talking about power or heat. We're talking about a Thetan. Well, unless you understand this as too great and exerted power and force within the ethical limits of the individual, then you will never understand the problems an operating thetan has. Strong men and big people very often have these problems. They're afraid they'll hurt somebody, and they always go around talking about hurting somebody and so forth, you know. And they pick up the little woman and a great blast of enthusiasm, you know, and they set her down and they're just about to say, "Dear, I brought you a box of candy to celebrate the anniversary," and she's standing there with two cracked ribs, you know. What they never get through their thick skulls is that really she didn't object. But the point I'm making here is a thetan, in dealing with himself, is dealing with somebody who is stronger than the fragility with which he is surrounded. And he compensates for this by reducing his power. Now let's talk about this telephone again. How do you answer a telephone as an OT? Well, the right way to answer a telephone is simply to pick it off of its cradle and put it up somewhere in your vicinity and talk into it. That's very simple, isn't it? But suppose you get mad at somebody on the other end of the phone. You go, "Crunch." That's so much Bakelite. The thing either goes into a fog of dust in the middle of the air or drips over the floor. How about the telephone line? Well, that fuses, of course, if you say into it, "Now listen." Severed your connection. That was the end of that. All right. Now, there are two solutions to this, and this is the solution that the operating thetan ordinarily took and was wrong. And that's to develop an involuntary intention. When the telephone rings, it springs into the air in his vicinity, and he talks. It actually will spring into the air and stay there. In other words, he's got an automatic action. Ring telephone, telephone springs into the air, you talk. Got that? Involuntary intention. He's got a postulate then which does things without his having to actively intend them. There's nothing wrong with this, but why an involuntary intention? Well, that's to keep him crushing telephones. And that makes it very easy to answer telephones, and the telephone stands there in the air, and you think this is very tricky. Well, that's all very well. That's all very well. But it's that same thing that gives you a time track. Apparently, there's no difference between an involuntary intention to act and an involuntary intention to duplicate and an involuntary intention to create. And that's probably the genesis of the time track. That's hypothetical. The other I'm giving you is absolutely actual. The telephone bit is the McCoy. I'm trying to get at the basis of this time track, you see? Strip away the whole time track. He gets into this, so he'll mock things up according to certain vibrations. It gets to be an automatic intention. And then he doesn't know what this automatic intention is. And then somebody comes along and gives him things for the automatic intention to mock up, which are things that would be bad for him. Or they jab the machinery of his automatic intention, don't you see? And they make him fight his own automatic intention. The next thing you know, he's got a messed up time track, and the next thing you know, he's solid, and the next thing you know, he picks up a meat body. See how it goes? But the withhold begins with the piece of cellophane. Steel is cellophane. Now, the other solution that I just spoke to you about is surround yourself with things that don't go boom. The idea, what's the idea of having a telephone that you can't pick up, that goes to powder of Bakelite and fused wires every time you pick it up? Well, the devil with it. It's something like you're trying to play croquet with a lady's watch as a mallet. You wouldn't do that ordinarily. You'd go out and find a croquet mallet. Well, you see a telephone like this that you're supposed to use all the time, recognize what's happening to you and put something there that you can handle. It's a simple solution, and you won't be going downhill. You find yourself on a big withhold all the time. What are you doing? You're withholding, you know, the basis of withholding. That sets you up to all sorts of things. But the main thing it sets you up to is this mechanism of automatic intention, and that sets you up to an automatic time track. Next thing you know, somebody's running out your engrams. Who's putting the engrams there? Well, you are. How do you stop putting the engrams there? Well, isn't there any way to stop putting the engrams there? Unless you eventually track it back to your automatic intentions and get your early track material, which undoes this. But you're not going to undo this time track so long as it's so charged you can't come near it or run anything with reality, don't you see? You fixed up your own theta trap just because you've been betrayed by theta traps. All sorts of things like this occur. All right, now that's so much of that. But what's this got to do with this galaxy and that sort of thing? Well, it has a lot to do with this galaxy. I don't think you could go into an ant house, one of these ant hills, with human fingers and rebuild these various places where they lay their eggs and store them. And I don't even think you could pick up very many ants with human fingers without crushing some. Well, what's the idea, see? What are you trying to do? What are you doing fooling around with an anthill? That's one of the questions. Now, these questions actually have to be answered from a technical viewpoint, but they have a great deal to do with the organizations of Scientology. A very great deal to do with that. What's this? Where are we going? Because we look at the character, the actual true character of an operating thetan. We recognize what we're dealing with here. We see very clearly that all this could be very upsetting in various directions. I think we have some responsibility in at least heading it off in the right direction and organizing it to some degree. And this is the only point of upset which I feel about this, is early on conceiving that free thetans were very dangerous and should be shot down in their tracks. People such as this group in Helitrobus started laying in implants and picking people up and weakening people down and doing all this sort of thing and all this nonsense. And worked on it very hard. What industry? Think of what would have happened if that industry had been devoted to a worthy cause. And this you possibly have not run into, but you will eventually before these implants. Planets were surrounded suddenly by radioactive cloud masses. And very often, a long time before the planet came under attack from these implant people, waves of radioactive clouds, Magellanic clouds, black and gray, would sweep over and engulf the planet. And it would be living in an atmosphere of radioactivity, which was highly antipathetic to the living beings, bodies, plants, anything else that was on this planet. Now, this period might be as long, well, it could be billions, certainly, quite ordinarily a million years before the first capture of your PC or something like that. And certainly was 100 or 2. All of a sudden, these otherwise clear skies that would ordinarily have merely rain clouds in them would become radioactive. And this was explained by the wise savants of the day. They were sat there stroking their long, useless diplomas. They explained it as a disintegration of the universe, natural phenomena, and so on. How did they explain it this way? Well, the hub of a galaxy has in it a great deal of radioactive material. It's not that it doesn't have stars and planets in it that are perfectly free from this, but there just happen to be more Magellanic clouds scattered around there than in other places. And a universe has vectors of force. They go out in a, like a, not really like an Archimedes spiral, but I don't know quite what the geometric figure is. It's the line that goes from a center out to the rim in a curve and hits the rim at an oblique. In other words, if you've seen some old wheels, spring wheels and so forth, are made this way sometimes. Anyway, there are lines of force in a galaxy. And these cookies had actually found how to detach matter along a line of force. And so they'd set a Magellanic cloud loose along one of these lines of force, and it would swing out of balance and move on out and engulf a system. And then swinging out further would engulf another system and would spend an awful long time hanging around the system as it went by, you see. And frankly, these clouds would get to systems which they didn't come near for maybe thousands and thousands of years. They didn't direct these clouds intimately, they just set them loose. And they would drift out through space. And these wise professors, I've never trusted a professor since, would sit around stroking their diplomas, saying, well, this is the natural consequences of the disintegration of a galaxy, a certain period in the life of a galaxy, the Magellanic radioactive masses at the interior of the hub begin to disperse themselves out toward the rim. And this is known as the Kepler-Spreplin law, and the Buplin-Buplin law, and the calculations are m to the gup-gup squared or the ribbity-rip-bop to the tenth power. Everybody sat around being very, very amazed. The truth of the matter is, somebody was letting them loose. And because of that scientific theory, nobody found out about it for a long time, that it was being done, because it was incredible that anybody would do it. The natural law that was not known, but you could do it. And so planetary systems would become engulfed in radioactive masses, gray and black. And the earmarks of such a planetary action was gray and black, gray towering masses of clouds. These Magellanic clouds would not otherwise have come anywhere near a planetary system. Well, there's such a thing as the Dark Horse Nebula in Orion today. You can maybe see some pictures of that in astronomy books. Well, that is one huge radioactive black mass towering up there. It's all light years across, you see. It's heavy, it's thick. Well, any piece of that, such a mass existing at the hub, any chunk of the Dark Horse Head Nebula set loose in the galaxy would spin on out and engulf systems. Now, when a system had been engulfed, they had it on their timetable, they would send ships in, and they had little orange-colored bombs that would talk, and speech and so forth was frozen into electronic capsules. It was all very clever. Utter insanity, you see. This makes it so incredible, nobody believes it, you see, and that was one of their greatest protections. Why would anybody go to this much trouble? So the clouds would talk, and you'd have a gray cloud going by, and it'd be saying, hark, 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 you see. Watch out, look out, who's there, who's that, you know. Sounds like a fun house. Or somebody'd find his front yard all full of black spots that looked like rabbits, and he'd come within them, and they'd suddenly explode. And all the vegetation started dying off around there, and he'd say, something's going wrong here. Or they'd plant something up like this. You'd see a big tangle of barbed wire on the edge of the seacoast, and a wrecked aircraft, and a pilot in a doll body pinned on a theta pole. Oh, you say, a poor fellow, I wonder what happened to him, you know, and you go over and here's this aircraft, and so on. He must have crashed and investigated this thing. What's wrong here, see? Of course, it's just a plant. You walk into it and the ground all of a sudden starts going crap, bap, crap, and saying various things. Well, Satan didn't know what the devil was happening. For some reason or other, the symbol of aircraft goes through all of this, weaves its way through this. Aircraft, they look like Pan American planes. rather stub-winged. Well, actually, that begins much earlier. That's back around 80-some trillion you will find aircraft being used as part of implants. Because the aircraft is the translating symbol of you need a machine to get you off a planet or into the air. You can't just levitate. Anyway, here you might find then that for some years, or for thousands of years, or for even some much greater, higher figure of years, that a planet had been engulfed with radioactive clouds and nobody had done anything at all on that planet. Went along like that for a long time. And then all of a sudden, one day, there was an orange burst and it said, "Hark, hark, look out, watch out, come here, go back, you know, come here, can't come here." All these double, it's always the double, you know, come here, can't come here. Where we get, I guess, the idea of double talk. And then they'd hang around. Now, don't think that your Thetan PC as a Thetan was picked up the first time. Oh, they'd try and they'd tug at him and they'd pick him up and try to pull him into the sky. Very clever. They had some means of contracting a beam. Traction beam. These guys were pretty smart electronically. Way advanced. And he'd resist it. But in a year or two, why, he'd run into another one of them. And again, he'd resist it. And a while later, he'd run into another one of them. And again, he'd resist it. And then he finally, he hasn't got his attention on it, and he's already been weakened down. He's collapsed a bit himself already, and he's beginning to worry. And the beam goes, and pulls him up into the sky and closes him in a capsule. And there he goes. One of the ways this was done, a small capsule evidently could be placed at will in space. It shot out a large bubble. The being would grab at the bubble or strike at it and be sucked at once into the capsule. Then the capsule would be retracted into an aircraft. Very interesting technology. All of this assaulted his credulity. Nobody, he couldn't understand what was happening. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before. Puzzled him. And of course, they'd ship him off. And anywhere between the next month or 6 months or something like that, they would shoot him into this period of the implant area and fix him on a post in a big bunch of stuff. Probably looked like railway sheds. I haven't had a very good look at it myself. Put him on a post, wobbled him around, and ran him through this implant of goals on a little monowheel pole trap. And it had the effigy of a body on it. You see, he didn't have a body and was put on the pole trap. The pole trap has a body on it. Didn't care whether somebody was used to having bodies or not used to having bodies. And away he'd go through this thing. Well, he'd eventually get off of it and go home. And then sooner or later, he was liable to have been picked up again. And this time he'd be found much weaker, and they would throw him through. Now, whether they could identify somebody who had been implanted once, which I rather think was the case, and send him through a second implant series because he'd had the first one or not, I don't know. But we'll know when we find our first person with only the second. And so far we haven't. We have found two and we've found four, but we have not found one or three. We'll know more about that, but that's not particularly the subject of my lecture today. Now, the Hellotrobus implants, call them the heaven implants to the public, these things were preceded then by a tremendous period of unrest. You can imagine what would happen on a planet which has been going along its peaceful ways, minding its own business, no trouble, no wars, nothing like that, and suddenly its clouds turn into radioactive masses. Well, maybe there wasn't a great deal of trouble for a while, but then all of a sudden you'd have these orange bursts suddenly coming down out of these clouds, representing God and chariots or something, you know, and all kinds of rumors being thrown around and talking this and that. After that period, the planet would be almost totally in revolt. No organized government was possible. People were going out sacrificing themselves. Everybody was in a terrific state of gloom or fantastic warfare. They would fight anybody they laid their eyes on because they didn't know what was happening. Trying to hold the fort during any period such as that was well nigh impossible. During those days, planetary forces usually consisted of territorial or terrestrial officers, terrestrial governments, and galactic officers who more or less didn't interfere particularly in the terrestrial affairs, but supervised its activities. You had a higher level of technology. In other words, a terrific chaos. Looked like this planet during the last couple of wars, during the last half century. You had this kind of an operating atmosphere, you see. Madmen suddenly get up and say, down with the Jews, you see. Kill all the Jews, and so forth. And then we'd have all kinds of people piled into the front-line trenches, shooting at all kinds of people or something, you see. And mad stuff going on, and the troops got madder and madder, and everybody got crazier and crazier, and things were more and more armed, and so on. So it got to be usual almost that your brave boys were charging over the top just fine, and they turned around to a man and shot you. Got so you just didn't know what to do, what to control, anything. That's that period before the implants. You had a very worried Thetan by that time. Now, what were these planets like before the implant occurred and before all this nonsense took place? Well, occasionally some eager beaver would show up and plant a few theta traps. Various things would occur from time to time. It caused an ARC break and so forth. It actually didn't disturb too much. There have been periods of tremendous activity in the past. But the time when the Helitrobus implants took place were a period of great tranquility, which had gone on for quite a while. These planets were pretty peaceful. And if anybody wants to say then that free Thetans are the cause of revolt, upset, and unrest on a planet, ha-ha, he had better examine the facts off the track and find out that it was only when they were threatened and made unfree that the government of planets became a chaotic mess, and you got such loathsome things as the government of Russia or the United States as it exists today. Just a bunch of corn. These were bad boys. Appropriate $16 billion for the psychiatrists. Electric shock everybody. Oh, they don't like us. We'll put them, tell them they're insane. And, you know, I mean, it's corny. You know. Nuts. That is the atmosphere. That is the atmosphere of an ungovernable area. That's the atmosphere of hysteria. You're going to find the world going crazier and crazier in that particular direction. Why? Because radioactive fallout is adequate enough to start keying it in. Various other little symptoms will fly up in the air. We're not looking at a calm future on this planet. If we weren't sitting here today doing our job, Lord knows what would happen on this planet. I don't wish to overemphasize it because it's there. This planet would be a billiard ball in just a few years, and anything left would just be a madhouse. But we have some responsibility in this direction ourselves. What do you think a Thetan feels like when he suddenly finds himself freed, or a third free, and perhaps able to operate some much, so, and sees around him the symbols which have been carried forward on the track, which destroyed his civilizations in the past? And what do you think his reaction is going to be? I consider this very interesting, and this becomes to you and me, boys and girls, a very interesting problem. A because I've gotten mad a few times about it myself. It's all right for me to say, well, actually, it isn't the Kennedy government that planted the Helitrobus implants. And I can say to this to myself, you know, sit there very rationally and say, well, they didn't do it, you see. And they're just implanted, too. And the reason they act this way and so forth is they're just implanted, too. Just implanted, too. Well, what the hell do they have to carry along all of the symbols, you see? Why do they have to act this way, you see? They don't have to perpetuate the misery that this created in this universe. The next thing you know, I'm roaring mad about the whole thing, you see? Well, all you'd have to do something like that is just let go of some of your voluntary intentions, you see? Well, I can appreciate this frame of mind. I can appreciate this frame of mind. This planet is in sort of a situation about, at least for a while, where they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. Because if we start in with our program, we can do everything we possibly can to make it go smoothly. I'm sure that it will, over any kind of an operating period of time, go quite smoothly. But this does not avoid a period of chaos. We can make that minimal, and should. And if we plan like mad and work like mad in that direction, we will make it minimal. But I don't think we can eliminate it. Because the chaos out of which all this travail was born was in itself too chaotic. Some of that will re-stimulate one way or the other. Look at it this way. The planet is doomed if we don't operate. So therefore, we should do all we can to operate smoothly and orderly. And my attention is therefore on organizational concerns which have very little to do with the legality of corporations under governments. How do we move through such a period? Well, I leave it to your imagination what might happen. You remember the fisherman and the genie. You know, the first time they let him out, he said, the first man that lets me out, I will reward him with the riches of earth. Nobody let him out for 10,000 years. So in the next 10,000 years, he began to nurse a grouch. He says, the next 10,000 years, if somebody lets me out, I will. And the very clever fisherman asked him to get back into the bottle. But I don't think that was clever of the fisherman. No, Thetans are mad. Down deep, they're mad. You get them halfway through one of these things, you find out they'll start getting madder and madder, not more apathetic and more apathetic. They philosophically have been understanding everything. They've understood it thoroughly. And so forth. Well, as long as they have that much rage in their hearts, their ability and power will, of course, be remarkably curtailed just by the nature of the situation. That in itself is a marked degree of safeguard. They who have power, who can control it. That stands in our stead and in our favor. But if we're just totally irresponsible for what we are doing and just let it happen and don't make any plans of any kind whatsoever, make no organizational structures of any kind whatsoever to handle anything, not hook anything up in any way, but just let it happen on a big, broad chaos, I think we will greatly have slowed down our forward progress over the thing, and I think we have some responsibility for straightening that out before it happens. It even answers up to the state of the universe. We're not even interested in that island, the galaxies over there, or the galaxies which are up the line, next galaxy, or something like that. We're not even interested in that. We will find ourselves, however, in almost immediate collision with the forces and powers of this galaxy. This is inevitable. And if Earth hasn't already cut her own throat. She's been sending out space probes. She's about ready to fire on the moon. Her actions are quite interesting. It's only her extremely isolated position and condition and other people's comlags that won't do anything about this at all. So there's another factor immediately interjected into the situation. Earth has blasted herself off into meat body space opera. Nuts, you know, absolute nuts. It's impossible. Nobody can do it, you know. Well, there she is, tempting this sort of thing. Somebody may not appreciate this. Now we talk about the man from Mars and that sort of thing. We say this is very far-flung, and this is very unreal to the people of Earth. As a matter of fact, it is so unreal to the people of Earth that the last time anybody announced a landing from Mars, Orson Welles' broadcast, they practically tore everything to pieces in the United States. Well, that didn't interest me. That didn't interest me at all that they tore things up in the United States. We'd had a lot of science fiction around that sort of thing. People could be worried, they'd be hysterical and so forth. Now, what interested me was that in Quito, Ecuador, it had no space opera. It had no tradition along in this line. It might not have been Quito. It was one of their big cities. Their main radio station put on Orson Welles' Landing of the Men from Mars, and the people rose up in the streets as a spontaneous action and tore that radio station, a skyscraper, to bits, and killed 17 people in the process. Bang! This answered an interesting question for me. These people we call the natives of Earth. They're blood brothers as far as this is concerned, and they know all about this. Otherwise, they wouldn't become that hysterical. So there are several factors that confront our immediate future. These are political and organizational factors. They have to do with facts of things as they are, not as things as we would like to have them. Well, if we handle the things as they are, it may possibly come about that we can also have things as we would like to have them. But I'm afraid we have to take it in that order and plan and work accordingly. And if we do, everything will be well. Of course, your job at once is to make somebody clear, make somebody OT. Of course, you're trodden on my heels. This is happening fast. People who couldn't handle 212 can handle this material we're issuing right now. Oh, they handled it in a very knuckleheaded fashion, I assure you, but they are handling it. Therefore, this process that we're using and these processes we're using are far more workable. They're fast and finite. And therefore, with everything else I have to do, I've got to look at this other side of the picture. What happens next? Well, let's hope it'll be as pleasant as possible. Thank you.